Park Project from NPR News. We are always online at npr.org. It was Abraham Lincoln who once said you could send most email to some people, and you could send some email to most people. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But if you want most of the email that's sent on the internet, then you have to come to the Bryant Park Project, as we do the most.
A good one, Mike.
Something like that.
Something like that. Okay, you go first.
I'll go first. I earned the right?
Yeah.
Forbes.com, just the Forbes actual magazine, one of the most emailed stories is how airports profit from your weight. We've all thought this, right? Let's say you're a Josh Rogerson type who's held overnight at the Minneapolis airport, as happened to our engineer the other day, and you're sitting there like, you know, the airlines aren't making money. I'm just being inconvenienced. Who's making money off this deal? And you've thought it, right? Who's making money, Ian?
Yeah, I actually, you know, I have sympathy for the skinny people.
they need more food?
Yeah.
Let's clarify. You mean weight, W-A-I-T?
Yeah. Right. Who is making the money are the people running the concession stands. Here's a quote, a fact. In 1990, only about 30% of airport revenue came from retail parking and concessions. Lately, it has risen to 50%, and at larger airports, as much as 60%. According to one study in 2005, a year in which airlines lost $10 billion, the airports earned $2 billion. Only five airports failed to turn a profit, so delayed flights mean more people spending money in the airports.
Bad Chili's food.
Yeah.
Sorry, Chili's. Annie Ann's.
Do the airlines themselves get a cut, though, of what they make in the concessions?
Okay. They don't?
No, they're losing money. Huh. No. No.
That's interesting.
Poor
Lauren.
Airlines.
All right, I've got mine is one of the most popular stories at Reuters and at MSNBC.com. So right now it's winter in Antarctica, and there's constant darkness. No, the sun is going to come back up again on August 20th.
Oh.
So
then how did they mount productions of Annie, claiming that the sun will come up tomorrow? That is a lie.
Well, there's 125 people on this base now.
Okay.
Together. So. Maybe this is an idea of how they can entertain themselves.
Okay.
But they have another idea of their own, apparently. Okay, there are 125 scientists and researchers on this base, and that's a skeletal winter staff down from about 1,000 in the summer. And I guess they need condoms really badly because last month the U.S. shipped them about 16,500 condoms. That's a one-year supply.
And according to who?
Like, the research.
Decides. This
what a one-year supply
in a year.
I started to fool the calculator and then changed my mind. But the research.
Wait, it's 1,500 people and they shipped.
No, 125 people.
Okay.
16,500 condoms.
16,000 condoms.
Oh,
my word. It's a little over 100 condoms per person. Per male, it's probably over 200, but I don't know.
So the station manager says that everybody knows everyone else so well that getting condoms is totally embarrassing, so they want to just make them available so people can be discreet.
Interesting.
Are you sure it's for the people? I mean, I know penguins are monogamous, but they're not celibate. Anyway.
Anyway, Ian,
hey.
What do you have to share with us today?
I have a most popular from Newser. This was actually in FloridaToday.com. Are you guys familiar with Fire in the Hole? It's this prank. I guess it's becoming a fad where mm-hmm. kids will go to a drive-thru, order something, get it, and then yell Fire in the Hole and throw it at the cashier who
That's
handed
awful.
It to them. Yeah, it's horrible.
Do they pay for it?
Well, yeah, you pay for it. What? And then while the person is getting your change, that's when you kind of aim and throw. So anyway, these two kids got caught. They had posted the video. The actual victim had tracked them down, and their sentence was that they had to post a YouTube apology. That's what the judge and the attorneys came up with.
Interesting.
Cool.
Yeah, it's kind of like modern-day pillory. Here we have a little bit of the YouTube video. Here it is.
We thought it would be funny to victimize restaurant employees by drenching them with ice-cold soda. We take this opportunity to apologize to the victims and take full responsibility for our irresponsible behavior. Instead, we should have used better judgment.
Yeah. Better judgment. Like there's a judgment call in
fault. Throw it softer.
Let me weigh
it. I hope there was also a fine of some kind involved.
Yeah, they're working out. They also got some, I think, 100 hours of community service, and they're working out the rest of the sentence now.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, people are maybe worried that, you know, they're just giving these guys more time on YouTube, which is kind of what they wanted
in
the first place. Yeah.
That did sound a little like a hostage video, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trish, what do you got? I hate Fire in the Hole.
Okay, so I have Google Trends once again. Mm-hmm. Number 3 overnight, the name Warren G. Harding.
Because of Wynn's rap.
Yeah, I don't think so, actually. Wynn is very great and popular, but he's not as popular as Stephen Colbert. So last night on Stephen Colbert, he referred to an exchange that was heard over the weekend on the McLaughlin Group, in which John McLaughlin said, Barack Obama, if elected, would not be the first black president of the U.S. The clip's a little too garbled for radio, but I'll quote. McLaughlin said, quote, Warren G. Harding was a Negro. Yeah, he used the word Negro. Okay, we're going to let that go, and we'll talk about what Stephen Colbert did with that information. Here's a little clip.
Little known fact, the G stands for gangsta. Thank you, Wikipedia. McLaughlin was referring to rumors spread during the 1920 election that Harding had a black great-grandmother. And if it was a rumor spread during a presidential campaign, you know it's got to be true. For instance, while John Kerry was not being wounded on his Swift boat, he was actually fathering John McCain's illegitimate black child who grew up to be a secret Muslim named Barack Obama.
Okay, none of that's true. So,
I mean, that part about rumors spread during the campaign is true.
Yes, that part is true. Warren G. Harding, the G does not, in fact, stand for gangsta. It stands for a word I can hardly pronounce, Gamaliel, I believe.
Gamaliel. He was a saint.
And so, of course, the rumor's been going around since the 1920s. The New York Times just did a reconsideration of that rumor, and they say the circumstantial case for Harding's mixed-race ancestry is, quote, intriguing, though not definitive.
I do remember reading that article and having my eyes almost pop out of my head.
Yeah, this whole thing made me think of the original Warren G, who is not actually the original Warren G, but can we hear a little bit?
It was a clear black night, a clear white moon. Warren G was on the streets trying to consume.
Yeah, Warren G and Nate Dogg.
Wait, are you saying this is Warren G Harding?
Yes, I am.
Just hit the east side of the LBC on a mission trying to find Mr. Warren G.
All right, Matt Martinez.
Enough of the fun.
Yeah.
Actually, I do have some big fun here. It's one of the most emailed and viewed at NPR.org right now. It's an interview with David Sedaris. Terry Gross, American Idol fan and host of WHYY's Fresh Air.
Oh, yeah, that.
Interviewed David. He has a new book out called When You Are Engulfed in Flames. And the interview is great. I loved it. And we don't have time to air the entire thing. It was like 30 minutes long. But there are two sections that I absolutely loved and I wanted to roll. Here they are.
This is a story about, it begins by talking about sort of a germ phobia. And then it goes on to somehow becomes about Christmas. I don't know how these things work. I finish them sometimes and I think, how the hell did I get there? But this is, I talk about seeing a parrot in a grocery store and about my friend Patsy thinking of germs in a movie theater.
Yeah, so in this piece you talk about how one of your sisters and one of your friends are so germophobic that they won't touch grocery carts because of the germs. They won't lean their head on a seat in a movie theater in case there's, lice on it. They won't just all kinds of things in public that they just won't touch because of the germs. And that leads you to these thoughts.
The only preventive thing I do is wash clothes after buying them in a thrift shop. This after catching crabs from a pair of used pants. I was in my mid-20s at the time and probably would have itched myself all the way to the bone had a friend not taken me to a drugstore where I got a bottle of something called Quell. After applying it, I raked through my pubic hair with a special knit comb, and what I came away with was a real eye-opener. These little monsters who'd been feasting for weeks on my flesh. I guess they're what Patsy imagines when she looks at a theater seat, what Lisa sees lurking on the handle of a grocery cart. They're minor, though, compared to what Hugh had. He was 8 years old and living in the Congo when he noticed a red spot on his leg. Nothing huge. Mosquito bite, he figured. The following day, the spot became more painful, and the day after that, he looked down and saw a worm poking out.
That was so horrifying, David, when I read it.
It's just, and his mom
such a
had
horrible
one.
Image. And his mom had one too. Yeah. It just is the perfect image for me about how, the human body could be so beautiful, but there are times when it could just be just like so horrible. Did you recoil in horror when you saw that?
When he told me about the worm, then I thought, oh my God, I've kissed this person. But when he told me that his mother had a worm like that too, I mean, if I saw a worm crawling out of my mother's leg, I would have just marched to the nearest orphanage and said, take me. I would have burned everything she'd ever given me, all pictures of herself, because that's somehow worse than having a worm in your own leg, is having a worm in your mother's leg. I mean, if her leg was wooden and it was a termite in there, even that would be bad. But a worm, a real worm in a flesh leg, that's repellent. But they lived in Africa and such things happened.
You know, because of stories like the story of James Fry and Margaret Jones, people who'd written things that they called memoirs that were actually not true, there's been a lot more scrutiny about, you know, personal essays and memoirs. There's even a piece in the New Republic that fact-checked some of your stories and just suggested there were a few exaggerations in early pieces and things that other people who were there didn't see the same way you saw it. Have standards changed now when it comes to, like, publishing personal essays or memoirs because of all the stuff that's, you know, that's out there that's been proven not to be true? Like, when you're published in The New Yorker and it's a personal essay, is there, like, fact-checking for that as if it were a repertorial piece?
The fact-checking is, at The New Yorker, has always been really intense. I had written in a story, I said that I talked about a painting that I bought, and I said that it cost as much as the average person pays for car insurance. It was just a throwaway line, right? I didn't want to give the exact price because I didn't want to put people off. So I said that costs as much as the person pays for car insurance. So the fact-checker said, well, how much did the painting cost? And I told him, and he said, that's more than the average person pays. And I said, okay, the average epileptic. And hung up the phone, and he calls back, and he said, you'd have to change that to the average epileptic in Connecticut because they have the highest insurance rates for drivers. But it wasn't really a story about that, right? So I said, okay, it costs as much as the average bumper pool table. And then he called and said, actually, bumper pool tables are a lot less than you might think. You're going to have to change that to a high-end bumper pool table. And I said, pool table. Just say pool table. I mean, and this was for a line that I'd considered a throwaway line. You know, I had another story about a clock in my dad's dining room, and I had said that it was, I don't know, walnut. So the fact checker called, and apparently the clock was cherry. So that's fine. And I changed to cherry. But pretty much, I would say that my pieces are fact checked the same way that a reported piece is.
Is it making you feel more inhibited as a writer?
Well, I mean, I think that I feel like I've always been pretty upfront about the way that I write. You know, I exaggerate. I've written about how much I exaggerate. I exaggerate about how much I exaggerate. And then it seemed like to me that all of a sudden the rules changed. You know, I mean, for a humorist, I always thought that you were allowed to do that. Like if somebody nags, in my writing, they nag, 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 right? So I'm not inventing the fact that they nag. I'm just turning up the volume on it a little bit.
That is David Sedaris being interviewed by Fresh Air's Terry Gross. You can listen to the entire interview and get all the links you heard in today's Most by heading over to our website. Have you heard? It's npr.org.
Oh, yeah.